community. Support for KAXE comes from UPM Blandin Paper, integrating bio and forest industries into a sustainable and innovation-driven future. More information at upmpaper.com. We also thank Grand Itasca Clinic and Hospital, home to an experienced OBGYN team that provides comprehensive women's health services, including maternity and advanced gynecology care, all in Grand Rapids. Learn more at granditasca.org. Weather for today, mostly sunny, highs in the upper 70s. We do have a slight chance of showers or thunderstorms this afternoon. Tonight, mostly cloudy, lows in the upper 50s. And for tomorrow, 50% chance of showers, otherwise partly sunny, highs in the upper 60s to low 70s. Support comes from ICTV. ICTV connects, informs, and empowers the community through diverse media. Learn more at watchictv.org. Coming up at 7:45, it is What We're Reading, hosted by our staff librarian, Tammy Bobrowski. Today we'll hear Minnesota lawyer-turned-writer Debbie Russell. She shares her experiences discovering family secrets while struggling with dysfunctional family dynamics in Crossing 51, not quite a memoir. And now from our local news team, it's a special edition of the Up North Report.
For KAXE News, I'm LaBrissa Donovan with a special edition of the Up North Report. Drivers in Bemidji and nearby communities may or may not have noticed new cameras attached to utility poles. Installed by the Paul Bunyan Drug Task Force, the devices are automatic license plate readers, or ALPRs. The devices take snapshots, which capture the time, date, place, and vehicle description, as well as plate information every time a vehicle passes by. Paul Bunyan Drug Task Force Commander Dave Hart of the Beltrami County Sheriff's Office says the devices were installed to further investigations into drug trafficking.
But they also serve, you know, a huge benefit to our member agencies of the Paul Bunyan Drug Task Force to assist them in their investigations for serious crime, violent crime, missing persons.
Many ALPR systems today use artificial intelligence to process the license plate images into data files. Vehicles of interest are searched by registered users and stored into a data file called a hot list. While Minnesota law dictates how this data can be used in criminal investigations, civil rights groups like the American Civil Liberties Union are concerned that this type of surveillance can be abused. Alicia Granzi, a staff attorney at the Minnesota chapter of the ACLU, explains.
There's definitely a concern that this data is going into databases that can be accessed by federal agencies, in particular, the Department of Homeland Security, ICE. The data is supposed to be used for criminal investigation.
Hart says he understands the concerns, but the task force and its use of ALPRs are in full compliance with the state law.
We're not trying to hide anything. If we wanted to conceal them or make them more covert, you know, we would have done that, but that's kind of not the purpose of them. The company that we're using is one of the largest and most reputable companies for ALPR technology in the country.
But concerns persist, including as recently as this past week. The Illinois Secretary of State issued an order for law enforcement agencies to cease sharing license plate data with federal or out-of-state agencies. The action came out of concern that Flock Safety and its privacy algorithms did not adhere to state law. This is the same company that made the ALPRs placed in the Bemidji area. The same day, the company announced it had ended a pilot program with federal agencies. Minnesota lawmakers initially put ALPR rules on the books in 2015. St. Louis County has 10 that were installed in 2024. The task force's 7 are posted in fixed locations around the city of Bemidji, and 1 is in nearby Northern Township. There is also 1 each in Park Rapids, Akeley, Manoman, and Pine River. Commander Hart says the recent federal designation of Beltrami County as a high-intensity drug trafficking area served as the main impetus for installing the ALPRs, but he notes the technology could also assist in an abduction case. Bemidji Mayor George Prince says the council was not notified about the ALPR installation, but he discussed his privacy concerns with the Bemidji Police Chief.
My quick take on it is it seems like it is a good thing overall and that it aids in investigations, but I'm certainly open to additional conversation on it.
Police in Grand Rapids are using mobile ALPR tech. Grand Rapids Police Chief Andy Morgan says the devices are integrated with the department's dash and body camera system.
Where we are now is agreements between Minnesota and the providers and the agencies using this technology that, you know, allows for that information to flow more freely than it has in the past.
Minnesota law says that data collected by ALPRs can only be compared to a statewide data repository, but Flock Safety promotes its capabilities with a network of 20 billion monthly reads across 4,600 agencies. Granzi says this is worrisome.
It's only supposed to really be pinging with the Minnesota license plate data file. The way that this statute is written, it's like, no, you can't have this central repository. You're not supposed to have that, but they do.
Instances of federal agencies accessing statewide or even national data have put some lawmakers and citizens on edge. But Flock Safety maintains that it doesn't own the data, and it's the agencies who own it and decide how it is shared. Read our deep dive on this topic at kaxe.org. That's it for the Up North Report. From the KAXE News Desk, I'm Larissa Donovan, telling the stories of Northern Minnesota through local news.
The Up North Report on KAXE is made possible by Woodland Bank, providing customers with personal and business banking solutions, as well as offering Kasasa checking accounts. You can learn more online at woodland.bank.
Coming up September 6th, we are so excited for Grand Rapids River Fest. Opening up will be Alan Sparhawk, who recently talked with Kari Hedlund about his new album with Trampled by Turtles.
I remember the time going like, man, I can't tell if this is any good. I'm questioning myself a lot here, but I don't know. There was a little bit of obligation, I think, because those guys had made room for me, put their trust in me, so to speak. I kind of had to tell myself, you know, I just need to push through and just sing, do the best I can, and trust that I'm in the hands of good people. I feel like I did. I found my voice. Thank you for thinking of me, and I'm glad to be there. Mim and I grew up out past Bemidji, so I'm looking forward to it.
Grand Rapids River Fest with Alan Sparhawk opening up, then Jeremy Albino, Margot Price, and Courtney Barnett. Get your tickets at GrandRapidsRiverFest.com. Turn up the
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Faldin.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. Today, China's president is hosting leaders from across Eurasia.
Those attending include Russia's leader, an adversary of the United States, and also the Prime Minister of India, a nation the U.S. has cultivated for many years as a friend. Lately, though, the Trump administration has been pushing India away. So how might China take advantage?
NPR international correspondent Dia Hadid is following this story. Hi there, Dia.
Hi, Steve.
Okay, so what's the context of this summit?
The context appears to be Trump's remaking of foreign policy, which has felt pretty unpredictable for much of the world, like tariffs on friends, the European Union and India, initial hostility to Ukraine, now peace talks. So since 2001, China sought to align Asian nations and former Soviet countries, in part through this grouping called the Shanghai Cooperation Organization.
Okay.
It's happened in fits and starts, though, but this summit appears to be the most important. It's certainly the largest, and it may well be because China sees an opening.
Do you mean an opening to lure American friends and allies more closely to China?
Yes, although we can't see any tangibles so far from the summit, but it may well be that the optics right now are the most important thing. President Xi has used his platform to denounce bullying behavior. He's made a point about the world not just having one superpower. He's offered millions of dollars of aid and loans to member countries. And consider the picture. All these leaders are gathering around Xi because they may well like to improve relations with China as insurance. And most important of them all is India.
Why would India need as insurance to be a little bit closer to its neighbor and sometimes enemy China?
Because President Trump's second administration has blown apart decades of bipartisan policy that brought India closer as a way of forming a bulwark against China. He's damaged those relations, analysts tell us, by imposing 50% tariffs on many exports, ostensibly punishment for India being a major buyer of Russian oil. And nearly every day, Trump's administration insult India or its leader. Most recently, trade advisor Peter Navarro described India as a laundromat for the Kremlin on Fox News.
Okay, so, I mean, I get the complaint. India has been buying Russian oil. The United States would rather that that stop. And there's also this kind of personal beef between the prime minister and the president. But is India actually getting closer to China as a result?
This is interesting because China and India, remember, they're neighbours. They share a border of over 2,000 miles through the Himalayas, although that border, where it should lie, remains in dispute. It's a fundamental tension between them and it remains unresolved. And there were some tangibles that happened before this meeting, but nothing at the summit. And that's perhaps a sign. Analysts tell us, look at the group picture. There's China's Xi, and then to his right, the leader of Kazakhstan, and then Modi. None of this is an accident. This is visual language to indicate that India comes to this meeting as being more vulnerable. Like on this, I spoke to Siddharth Ramani. He's a fellow at the Council for Strategic and Defence Research. It's based in New Delhi. And he says, look, a weakened India may well strengthen China's hand vis-a-vis the United States.
If the US is still intent on balancing China, it could be underestimating the ways in which this present disruption could force India towards a relationship with China.
A relationship with China that is fundamentally unequal and has been made more unequal, he says, by Trump's tariffs and this daily browbeating. And effectively, he says, one way you can understand President Xi hosting this massive summit is that America has actually strengthened Beijing's hand in the world.
NPR's Dia Hadid, thanks so much.
You're welcome, Steve.
China's summit comes just a few days after a federal appeals court ruled that Trump's Liberation Day tariffs are unlawful. The judges allowed the tariffs to remain in effect until at least mid-October in anticipation of the administration appealing to the Supreme Court. So how much of a factor are those import taxes, plus even higher tariffs because of India buying Russian oil, in reshaping India's foreign policy? Joining us now to discuss is economist Devashish Mitra. He's a professor at Syracuse University and specializes in international trade and the Indian economy. Good morning, and thank you for being on the program.
Thank you, Leila. Good morning.
How significant are these U.S. tariffs totaling 50% for India's economy?
They're very significant because the estimates are that it will shave off about 1% of India's GDP. The projected growth rate was about 6.5% for next year. It could go down to about 5.5% or even lower as a result of the tariff. So they are pretty significant for India. India exports a lot of labor-intensive manufacturers like apparel, textiles, footwear, jewelry, etc. To the United States. On the other hand, India's main exports to the U.S. are services, and services don't get impacted by these tariffs, and it's very difficult to put tariffs on services. But on the other hand, it's quite likely that President Trump will restrict H-1B visas and other temporary work visas on which services exports rely. So this is pretty significant.
And how are they being received? I mean, does India have any leverage to push back against the tariffs?
So India has had a huge geopolitical importance within the region. Mm-hmm. India is has a population of 1.4 billion, and it's a large democracy next to China, which has a similar population, a bigger economy, but is not a democracy. So India was, one of US's strong allies in the region and was a counter to China. So it's going to make a huge difference.
So could these tariffs shift those alliances and that dynamic? I mean, because India has historically tried to...
I think the tariffs have already started pushing India towards China. And, you know, there have been statements made on both sides that So for example, China's ambassador said that China opposes Washington's steep tariffs on India and will firmly stand with India. Prime Minister Modi is visiting China for the first time in 7 years, and going to this, and he is at the Shanghai Cooperation Organization Summit, which is of huge significance. You have President Xi there, but also President Putin, who's there. You know, Iran's head of state is there, and lots of other high-profile leaders are attending the summit.
And as you mentioned, the size of India's population and its relationship historically with the U.S., mm-hmm. India was seen or considered a counterweight to China in Asia.
Yes.
After what you just described, I mean, does that still hold true?
No, it doesn't hold true because India feels singled out now. India has been, basically, there's an extra 25% tariff, 25 plus 25. It makes it 50, and that extra 25% tariff is because they're saying it's because India is buying Russian oil, and they're putting pressure on India not to buy Russian oil. But there are many other countries that buy Russian oil. China buys more Russian oil, and then the U.S. buys uranium, palladium, and fertilizers from Russia.
Devashish Mitra is an economics professor at Syracuse University. Thank you for your time and your insights.
Thank you.
In other tariff news, fans of Korean skincare products are taking inventory after a frenzy of placing online orders from international retailers. The de minimis tariff exemption that used to apply to small shipments from abroad ended on Friday. Yes, an appeals court and a lower court have both found the president exceeded his authority by constantly changing import taxes on his own, but that ruling is on hold until the Supreme Court speaks. From Member Station KCRW, Megan Jamerson reports.
Last week, TikTok was full of posts from people like Tiffany Chow, who were racing to stock up on their favorite skincare products from South Korea-based online retailers like Olive Young.
I cannot live without my Korean or Japanese sunscreen. I placed a huge skincare haul with Olive Young.
Korean skincare products have a cult following, in part because of how cheap they are compared to other high-quality products. According to the U.S. International Trade Commission, the U.S. imported $1.7 billion worth of South Korean cosmetics in 2024. Before last Friday, when you placed an order from South Korea, it was exempt from tariffs if it was under $800. Now those packages will be subject to either a tariff of 15% or a flat fee of $80 per package. That means your $16 tube of sunscreen got a lot more expensive.
It would take the several months to see the full impact.
That's Moonsop Lee. He's an economics professor at UC San Diego who specializes in the Korean economy. He says if people don't find a product they love in the U.S., they may be willing to pay the higher prices.
Korean skincare products have so unique features, and it's also quite popular, I mean, partly because of the huge popularity in the K-pop culture.
There are some retailers in the U.S. that sell these products. Many couldn't take advantage of de minimis because they order in bulk, but they were already dealing with tariffs that went into effect in August. Vanessa Nebhani owns a Korean skincare shop in Pasadena, California, called Playlab Beauty. She stocked up on Korean sunscreen before the tariff. She hasn't raised her prices yet.
When people are, you know, standing in our store with their phones out, price comparing against, you know, Amazon or Olive Young or whatever it is, that extra dollar matters.
But as a small business owner, she can only eat the cost of tariffs for so long. For NPR News, I'm Megan Jamerson in Los Angeles.
This is NPR News.
It's 7:19. You're listening to the Monday Morning Show here on People Powered KAXC. Good morning. I'm Jennifer Barr. Happy Labor Day. Support comes from Sanford Health with primary care locations in Bemidji and across the Upper Midwest. Sanford Health is committed to providing care close to home. Learn more at sanfordhealth.org. And we thank Hibbing Chrysler Center, serving northern Minnesota, carrying Chrysler, Dodge, Jeep, and Ram vehicles with staff available to assist on the Beltline in Hibbing or at hibbingchrysler.us. Weather today, mostly sunny, slight chance for showers with highs in the upper 70s. Tonight, mostly cloudy, lows in the upper 50s, and a slight chance for showers and thunderstorms. Tomorrow, partly sunny, highs in the upper 60s to low 70s, and a 50% chance of showers. Looks like we'll be cooling down by midweek. Support comes from Timberlake Restaurant in Grand Rapids, host the Martini Monday Music Series. Rich Matson and Jermaine Gemberling perform on September 8th from 5 to 8 p.m. This acoustic duo features country, folk, and rock classics. More information at TimberlakeLodgeHotel.com. The Virginia Historical Society's annual Fall Fest is this Saturday, September 6th, in the Lions Club building at Alcott Park, starting at 4 p.m. with grilled burgers and brats. The featured speaker is Mark Sage. He'll talk about Frank Higgins, one of many sky pilots during the logging era. More news is next.
NPR comes from the station. And from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 30,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public. From Americans United for Separation of Church and State, since 1946, AU has supported the First Amendment right of freedom of religion. More at au.org. From Fisher Investments, as a fiduciary, Fisher Investments is obligated to act in their clients' best interest. Learn more at fisherinvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. And from listeners like you who donate to this NPR station.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Fadel.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. Here's an irony of this moment. Some people say the most outrageous things, but when critics write about entertainment, they become more polite over time. The writer Calafasane says critics seem to be muffling their opinions of music.
I always get annoyed when people say that music brings us together because one of the things it can do is give us ways to differentiate ourselves.
Sane wrote a little history of music criticism in The New Yorker, and he says critics have lost their edge when compared with critics of the 1960s and 70s.
There's this guy named Robert Christgau who called himself the Dean of American Rock Criticism, who literally gave letter grades to albums in the Village Voice. So Donnie Hathaway, he described as, quote, supper club melodrama and homogenized jazz, and gave that album a D minus.
Ow.
George Harrison, Dark Horse, he called him a, quote, horse dork, C minus. There's this famous review in Rolling Stone by Grail Marcus of Bob Dylan's self-portrait album, which began, "What is this?"
My daddy, he made whiskey. My granddaddy, he did too.
So there was this idea that rock critics in particular were going to fight about music. We're going to have strong and fierce opinions. And to me, as a kid, as I started to read some of these older articles, that seemed like part of the fun.
Part of the story you tell is that people were entertained by these criticisms and maybe didn't take them entirely seriously. You could be a fan of George Harrison and read the horrible review of George Harrison and still kind of enjoy it.
Yeah, I mean, in pro wrestling, they call it kayfabe, right? The idea that you're kind of staying in character and that the audience likes a good fight. And also, there was this idea that, well, rock and roll was this newish music that was kind of rude. So the critics were going to be kind of rude, too.
Well, what then began to happen as the years went on to music criticism?
There was this idea, I wrote about it in 2004, of this thing called rockism. The idea that critics were maybe a little too devoted to some of the myths of rock and roll, and they were missing some other kinds of music. They were maybe not listening carefully enough to pop music or R&B or country music. Hmm. And people started to talk about something called poptimism. The idea was, instead of being raucous, instead of being focused on loud guitars and sweaty guys in leather jackets, we were going to maybe celebrate pop music. And so instead of saying, oh, this boy band is just a bunch of sellouts making music to make money, they said, no, actually, this hit single is pretty good. And that movement became increasingly influential in music criticism.
I'm realizing that one of the things you're describing then is what was happening in the broader society. Instead of having one narrative, one set of values, we become more multicultural and people aren't so sure of their values and try to understand other people's points of view.
That's exactly right. I mean, anyone who has this weird job of being a music critic faces people who ask them, who the hell are you to tell me what music to like? And that's a reasonable feeling to have, but it can be kind of fatal to the enterprise of criticism.
Was there another factor here? Social media gave fans the ability to push back on critics.
Well, yeah, fans didn't used to really have a voice, right? Musicians would make the records, critics would say what they thought, and that was kind of the end of it. But with social media, the conversation started to go in all sorts of different directions.
Taylor Swift is in the news the last few days, in case you missed it. What role did Taylor Swift play in this transition?
Well, Taylor Swift was someone, on the one hand, whose fans were and are ferocious. And critics sometimes complained that if they said something negative about Taylor Swift, they got reprisals from her fans. At one point, the magazine Paste published a review of the Taylor Swift album, Tortured Poets. And the review was kind of negative, and it was published without a byline. And the idea was that this would maybe help keep the critic safe from any backlash from Taylor Swift's fans.
Witness protection program, okay.
Exactly right. The critic with a brown paper bag over her head. And, you know, it's kind of funny, but it's a real sense of the pressure that critics sometimes felt.
I feel that you've again touched on broader trends in society. We have raised yeah. the cost of inconvenient or impolite speech.
Yes, and while also giving people more freedom. One of the things I noticed was that sometimes it seemed like the really harsh reviews of albums were coming from everyday users online, on social media. And then when you read a professional critic, you'd read something more thoughtful, more polite.
What's an example of what you're talking about?
One example is the singer Lorde put out a record in 2021 called Solar Power. And it got polite reviews. Rolling Stone gave it 3.5 stars.
My cheeks in that color, overripe peaches. No shirt, no shoes, only my features. My boy behind me, he's taking pictures.
In fact, one of the most negative reviews of the album came from Lorde herself. Later in an interview, she said that the album was her attempt to be chill and kind of wafty, and she remembers thinking, actually, I don't think this is me. So you have this bizarre situation where professional critics were kinder to Lorde than she herself was. You sometimes hear it said that an artist is her own worst critic, but I don't think we want that to be literally true.
Why, if at all, does it matter if criticism has become much more polite?
You're asking a slightly more polite version of the question, who cares? One answer is that for some of us, it's fun to read slightly unhinged criticism. And it reflects something true about what it's like to be a person to listen to music. If you're talking to your friend about music, you'll probably hear some extremely strong and categorical opinions, right? Whether it's, I hate metal, whether it's hip hop hasn't been good since 2005. Mm-hmm. People tend to have really strong views. So I get a little skeptical when the critical reviews don't seem that strong. If we can't have a frank exchange of views about Taylor Swift, maybe we're losing our ability a little bit to have frank exchanges of views about everything else.
Khalif Hassaneh writes for The New Yorker. His latest article is called How Music Criticism Lost Its Edge. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
This is NPR News.
It is 7:29. Good morning. Thanks for listening to the Monday Morning Show on this Labor Day on KAXE. I'm Jennifer Barr. Coming up in a few moments, best wishes. We'll do our best to wish friends and neighbors happy birthday, happy anniversary. We'll also hear our daily dose of phonology and then what we're reading, hosted by Tammy Bobrowski. Today, I'll listen back to Tammy's conversation with Minnesota lawyer turned writer Debbie Russell about her book, Crossing 51, Not Quite a Memoir. Support comes from Dale's Auto Body, serving the auto body needs of Grand Rapids and surrounding communities since 1984. Performing auto body and collision repair, as well as auto glass replacement, dedicated to getting you back on the road after an accident. More information at dalesautobodyinc.com. And we thank the First National Bank of Coleraine since 1906, serving the needs of the community and working with their friends and neighbors with branches in Coleraine and Grand Rapids. More information at coleraine.com, member FDIC. Weather for today, mostly sunny, slight chance of showers with highs in the upper 70s, and tonight mostly cloudy, lows in the upper 50s, slight chance of showers and thunderstorms. Tomorrow, partly sunny, highs in the upper 60s to low 70s, and a 50% chance of showers. Support comes from North Homes Children and Family Services, providing compassionate mental health services to children and families at home, school, and in the community. More information at northhomes.org. It is time now for best wishes. Taking a look first at yesterday, August 31st, happy 40th anniversary to Rick and Mary Augustine from Beauvais. Tanya and Dustin Prim, happy 23rd anniversary to you in Bemidji. Scott and Monica Anderegg, happy 34 years of marriage. They are the Castlake Eastsiders on Green Cheese. Robin Cunningham, happy 63rd birthday to you in Smoky Hills. Peggy Schultz celebrated her 65th birthday in Bemidji. Karen Lukacek, happy 68th in Cohasset. Billy Shaw, happy birthday to you, turning 35 in Blaine. And Monica Anderegg, also celebrating a birthday yesterday. Today is September 1st. Welcome to a new month, and happy anniversary to Doug and Lori Lloyd from Grand Rapids. Paul and Deb Olson celebrating 47 years today, also in Grand Rapids. Kevin and Donna Drummond, happy anniversary to you in Richfield. James DeYoung, happy 63rd in Nisswa. And Emily Roskowski is turning 34 today. Our best wishes to you all. We're going to hear a song now from Margot Price. She is performing this Saturday at Grand Rapids River Fest, along with Courtney Barnett, Jeremy Albino, and Alan Sparhawk. Find your tickets and more information, grandrapidsriverfest.com. This song features Sharon Van Etten, and it's called Radio.
I think I need to take some time out. And I wanna turn my phone off. I just wanna be alone. Just let me be alone today. I'm saving all my extra money. Go out, get what they never buy me. Why do I feel so sick and tired? Confused about how I feel. Let them fool you about what is real. I think the whole world's going crazy, and it makes us look insane. But all this thinking makes my head hurt, and all this running makes my feet hurt. I work my back right off my shirt. Got my shoes and run away.
Margaret Price with the song Radio. You can see her this Saturday at Grand Rapids River Fest. Find your tickets and more information at grandrapidsriverfest.com. Lineup features Courtney Barnett, Jeremy Albino, and Alan Sparhawk as well. I'm Jennifer Barr. Thanks for listening to the Monday Morning Show. In a moment, our daily dose of phonology. We receive support from Headwaters Unitarian Universalist Fellowship in Bemidji. Huff's congregation strives to build bridges with the community and welcomes all to seek truth, practice love, and celebrate life. Learn more at headwatersuu.org. We also thank Escape by the Lake on Paul Bunyan Drive in Bemidji, offering immersive-themed experiences where teams work together to solve puzzles and find clues to escape within the hour. Learn more about the different themed rooms at escapebythelake.com. Phenology is the rhythmic, biological nature of events as they relate to climate. It is time for our daily dose of phenology with John Latimer.
On this date, September 1st, 1999, I noted what I hoped were the last of the horseflies. Horseflies are large, brown, biting flies that have jaws that work like two knives slicing back and forth, sort of perpendicular to their body alignment. And those slicing mouth parts cut open your skin, and then the fly proceeds to lap up the blood. Now, she needs the blood as a means of making her eggs. She needs the protein from the blood to make the eggs that are going to be next year's horseflies. And so I hate to give them any of my blood, if at all possible. And this late in September marks what I always hope for as the last of the horseflies.
That's our daily phenology. Tune in tomorrow morning, 7:20, for John Latimer's latest observations. And soon we'll be having our student talkbacks from our schools. They are starting back tomorrow. I'm Jennifer Barr. Thanks for listening to the Monday Morning Show. It is time for What We're Reading, produced by our staff librarian, Tammy Bobrowski. Today, we're going to listen back to a conversation with Minnesota lawyer-turned-writer Debbie Russell. She shares her experiences discovering family secrets while struggling with dysfunctional family dynamics in Crossing 51, Not Quite a Memoir.
Debbie Russell is a Minnesota lawyer-turned-writer. Her debut book is called Crossing 51, Not Quite a Memoir. 10 years ago, Debbie found herself at the center of family secrets and struggles. As her father was being admitted to hospice, Debbie discovered that in 1951, her grandfather had been admitted to a narcotics farm for drug addiction. While Debbie was working to unravel this family history, her already complex relationship with her mother grew increasingly volatile, prompting Debbie to seek therapy. We begin our What We're Reading interview with Debbie explaining why she calls Crossing 51 not quite a memoir.
I've had people say, well, is that because it's part fiction? And actually, it's not. And I think if I had been a little more precise, I would have called it a family memoir, because it is a story of my grandfather, as well as my story. And then my dad's story is kind of sandwiched in between. So it's multi-generational. When I was studying genres, because I'm not a writer by trade, I thought family saga was a much better fit for it. But because it is nonfiction, you've got to put it in the box. So the Not Quite a Memoir refers to the three generations of family stories.
So this is your first book. What would you like people to know about you before getting into it?
Well, I am what I like to call myself a lawyer turned writer. I was for about 25 years an assistant Hennepin County attorney in Minneapolis. And for most of my career, I prosecuted violent crimes. And it was a pretty stressful job. I did a lot of writing, but it was legal writing, which is really very, very different from creative writing. But in, I think it was 2016 or so, I started a blog, which is where I started to try to write a little more from the heart, creatively. And so I was kind of doing that at the same time as I was doing my law job. And I left my law job in 2020, and I knew I wanted to write this book. I just wasn't quite sure how it was going to take form and what it was going to ultimately be. But it's quite a jump from legal writing to creative writing. And one of the biggest jumps I learned from my editor, who said, "You use a lot of passive voice." And I never thought I was passive voice. I'm not passive anything, but in writing, it makes a big difference. And so once I started to kind of understand that and learn how to make my sentences much more active, I think it improved my writing dramatically.
So as you mentioned, a big part of this book is you dealing with all these family issues that had kind of come up at the same time. In particular, your father's deteriorating health due to Parkinson's disease. Can you tell us a little bit about him?
Oh, my dad was just the greatest. And, you know, we're coming up on Father's Day this coming weekend. Mm-hmm. And I just always remember him as just this really open, accepting, curious person. He was so different from my mother in that he could just take in whatever came his way. And he always seemed to be cheerful about it. I mean, it was kind of stunning. His attitude as the Parkinson's started to just wear him down was one of, it seemed like eternal optimism. And I note in the book, at some point I thought maybe he was delusional. And my therapist at the time said, "No, I think he's just really optimistic." And Parkinson's it's such an awful, awful disease because it robs a person of their physical abilities. And his mind right up until the end was super, super sharp. And that was the tragedy of it all. He knew what was happening. He knew that he couldn't do the things that he had done previously. And just for me, watching it all was so heartbreaking. But he handled it really with such courage and just fortitude, I guess I would say.
This is what we're reading. We're talking with Minnesota lawyer turned writer Debbie Russell. Her book is called Crossing 51, Not Quite a Memoir. Debbie, while you were dealing with this, you had shortly before that received from your parents some boxes. They were cleaning out their house, some boxes that ended up containing a lot of old family letters and documents. And you made a big discovery about your grandfather. Can you tell us about what that was?
Sure. And I think, you know, as I talk with people about the book, I hear from so many people that, oh, yes, the box of family memorabilia is the big word that encompasses a whole lot of different things. And in one of these boxes was this very pristine file folder that was bound with a rubber band. And it really looked like it had never been opened. And I opened it up, and right on the top was some official looking correspondence between my grandfather and the United States Public Health Service, wherein he's writing to the director and asking for some guidance regarding his own addiction. And my grandfather was a doctor, a successful surgeon. And in this very first letter, he lays out a number of drugs that he had been taking. By his explanation, it was to manage his asthma. But I have I've shared these drugs and their dosages with people who know a bit about them, and it seemed like it was really excessive for managing asthma, and Demerol particularly was almost counterindicated for asthma because it depresses one's breathing. But in any event, this letter was such an example of his self-awareness, where he's writing to this director because of an article he had seen in a medical magazine. And he basically said, I'm wondering if maybe it's time for me to seek some help. And he was looking at these two locked federal facilities that were called narcotic farms. And they had been established in the 1930s, I think. And when he wrote this letter, it was the fall of 1951. And there was one located in Lexington and the other was in Fort Worth. And he basically just said, I wonder if perhaps I shouldn't try some rehabilitation. And he got a form letter back that said, we can't evaluate you, but you would need to submit an application. And so then as we go through this file folder, it turns out he flew to Fort Worth, Texas, and never came home. And I think that was kind of a surprise to the rest of the family, given that it was a week or so before Christmas of 1951. He made kind of an impulsive decision to just stay there. And then the rest of the folder is, in chronological order, letters that he wrote the family and that the family wrote back to him. So letters from my grandmother, from my dad. I think there was one or two from my aunt and uncle who were still in San Diego at the time. So they're in San Diego and my grandfather's in Fort Worth, Texas. And he can only write two letters a week, but he can get in as many as there are people to write him. So but he does such a detailed description of his day, his schedule, his surroundings. And at some point, he earns the privilege of actually assisting in surgeries at this facility. And it's really remarkable because the vast majority of the population at these facilities was made up of younger federal convicts. So, you know, young men who had been convicted of drug offenses federally, and as a condition of their sentence, were compelled to be at this drug rehab place. My grandfather went voluntarily, so he could have left at any time, but he chose to spend the entire 4 months there, and he left when the facility had determined he was well enough to go back to his life and his practice.
Going through your book, reading your book, there seems to be this kind of chain developing where you're dealing with your father's health, you're learning about your grandfather's health history, your complicated relationship with your mother, you're also dealing with your own well-being. How are you doing? Can you tell us like what all of this having to deal with these family issues and health issues and discovering secrets in the past? Can you talk about how that kind of weighed down on you and let us know how you're doing now?
Well, I am doing really, really well. And thank you for asking. This book has really been an amazing gift, I think, to me. But also, it's been conduit for conversation with other people. And I think what was surprising to me when it first came out was the number of people who would approach me or send me a note on my website or write a review that talked about how much they could relate to my story. And I think the thing about memoir, or in my case, not quite a memoir, you're writing about your own story. And I think sometimes we can get very siloed as far as feeling like nobody's going through what we're going through. It's incredibly lonely. And you hold all this inside. And the stress and the loneliness can really do a number on you. And for me, first going to therapy was helpful to some extent, as you probably know from reading the book. But what has been most helpful is just the connections that I have made with other people, women particularly, who recognize aspects of my mother in their mother, had no idea that was such a common theme in families. I was able to learn a lot about how dysfunctional families relate to each other and how it's the thing that's really hard to talk about, because I think we all assume that everybody else has just a fabulous family because that's what's splashed out on social media, in the holiday cards, the holiday newsletters. It's all the good stuff and none of the conflict, none of the trauma or pain. And I think for me, just being out and about and connecting with people who have gone through similar situations has really, it's just been remarkable. I feel very free. I feel really connected, like with the universe, because of all of the things that we share around some of the themes in the book. So it has really presented me with gifts far beyond what I could have imagined.
Debbie Russell is the Minnesota writer of Crossing 51, Not Quite a Memoir. This is a really interesting story, extensively researched, and it will have you thinking about your own family dynamics, the good and the bad. It's What We're Reading. I'm Tammy Bobrowski.
Labor Day weekend ends the summer travel season, right?
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by Schwab. Schwab offers investors choices like full-service wealth management, self-directed investing options, and trading on thinkorswim. More at schwab.com.
For Marketplace, I'm Nova Safo and for David Brancaccio. Let's talk summer travel. It's supposed to be peak tourism and was forecast to be slow this year. But on both points, there's surprising news. Joining me is Eileen Crowley. She tracks the transportation and hospitality industry at the audit and advisory firm Deloitte. Good morning.
Glad to be here.
Has the summer travel season turned out as we expected?
One of the biggest trends that we're seeing is that folks are actually taking more trips this summer and expected to. So, you know, the trips might be a little bit quicker and shorter. But again, that prioritization of leisure travel is continuing for Americans is what we're seeing.
So some signs of good news, but we are seeing some tweaks perhaps to summer travel plans for Americans. What have those tweaks been besides the shorter, maybe quicker trips?
You are definitely correct. I like to refer to our travelers this summer as more the budget conscious traveler, a little bit more frugal than perhaps in summers past. But they're doing, you know, less international trips. They're also thinking about spending less once they get to a destination. A number of our travelers that we surveyed actually are intending to travel after Labor Day, which typically has been the end of the, you know, summer-defined travel season. And many are doing that because of the, you know, shoulder season being perhaps a little bit less expensive and keeping in line with their budgets.
Yeah, and airlines alluded to this in their forecasts for the rest of the year, right? They're saying that they're seeing kind of the usually kind of heavy summer demand period kind of get instead kind of spread out and thinned out a bit and going and kind of spilling into the fall.
We took a look back to our survey results from 2022 about travel post-Labor Day, and there was about 12% of Americans that indicated they intended to take their marquee or biggest trip of the summer season after Labor Day. If you look at the results of our survey this year in 2025, that percentage is closer to 23%. So it's almost doubled in the last 3 years of our survey.
Considering kind of the shifting travel patterns and the expanding period of travel, what do you expect for the fall? Where are we headed?
I think you'll see, like I mentioned, more travelers post-Labor Day. They are intending to stretch that summer season out in many regards to get maybe perhaps a better pricing, whether it's hotels or airfares. And depending upon how the economy continues to fare, you know, you could see some folks, or some of our American travelers staying with family and friends actually versus paid lodging. again, it all surrounds the theme of a more frugal traveler, especially if they're feeling less financially secure.
All right, Deloitte's Eileen Crowley, thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
And U.S. markets, by the way, are on holiday, closed for Labor Day.
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by Progressive Insurance. The Name Your Price tool provides a range of coverage options. Progressive.com. Price and coverage match limited by state law. And by Avalara, providing cloud-based solutions for businesses to manage property tax compliance. Learn more at avalara.com/property tax.
Millions of Americans have some form of criminal record, an arrest, charge, or conviction. That record can go on to limit access to housing, employment, and education, even if an offense is dismissed. While some states offer automatic record expungement for qualified individuals, others require a court petition, which can be both expensive and confusing. A new tech startup is looking to make record expungement less complicated with the assistance of artificial intelligence.
My name is Roger Roman, and I am the co-founder of Legalese. So my co-founder, Lawrence Blackman, he's a practicing attorney. You know, he would come with ideas about things that could be fixed, basically, in the legal system. And expungement was one that he kept coming back to. Like a true attorney, he was very persistent and convincing. And I started to help him build an MVP, which was our first model to help people basically go ahead and figure out if they were eligible, one, for an expungement, and then help them in terms of processing it. We built that MVP a couple of years ago, and we realized that there was something there. There was a huge gap in the market in this space. Early on, you know, we thought our ideal customer profile was of a certain demographic. You know, we had our preconceived notions about who this could help. But over time, we found that this problem transcends all economic levels. It transcends race. It transcends everything. We've had investors say, hey, you know, I needed an expungement similar to Lawrence, right? He's a state representative and attorney. He needed to get an expungement. We started in Mississippi, one, because Mississippi was perceived as a challenge to us early on in terms of their judicial system. There's still a lot of reliance on paper. In addition to that, my co-founder, Lawrence, is a practicing attorney there. He's barred. He's also a state representative, right? So we had a lot of insight into how things move with the courts. The incarceration rate and the people with criminal records in Mississippi is one of the highest in the country. Unfortunately, it was fertile ground to test out our model and to build it. To be completely honest, we felt that if we could make this work in Mississippi, it would be a lot easier to make it work in other states that might have a little more advanced judicial system and might be a little more adept to using technology to solve these issues. I might be a little biased, but, you know, I'm a big fan of AI. Maybe in 20 years when we're all slaves to, you know, some AI overlord, right? I might regret saying this, but today it just feels like a superpower. A lot of times I joke with my co-founders about it being similar to a calculator, right? You know, in school, we were told not to use a calculator because we had to learn how to do math ourselves. And, you know, we wouldn't always have access to a calculator. And here we are today with cell phones with calculators on them. And we pretty much have access to a calculator in every predicament. So I know there's a lot of fear around AI and the potential power it has. But I think used in the right space and used, you know, responsibly, it can really help a lot of people and even the playing fields in a lot of spaces.
That's Roger Roman of Legalese, and I'm Nova Safo with the Marketplace Morning Report. From APM, American Public Media.